Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 4th, 2012. It may still be a lousy job market out there, but these kids, well, they're young enough to believe their dream job awaits.
I want to be a vet.
I want to work for Cirque du Soleil.
And notice nobody wants to be an engineer yet.
Well, that's my second choice.
Okay.
We'll hear what they learned from mom and dad in the office. And maybe it's time to put your money in a bottle, a wine bottle.
You know, on average, 27% over the last 4 years for me, which I think is a pretty good investment, but when you stack it up against the equity market.
And NFL great and multimillionaire Warren Sapp gives his first broadcast interview since filing for Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
My salary went from $5 million to under $1 million. I went through a divorce. And the financial crisis, with those three things happening at one time, it really put me in a unique situation. And trust me, you don't choose this.
So how does it happen? It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
So let's talk about obsession. Obsession with numbers, because this is something that we in the media are completely obsessed with. Every month, a slew of new numbers about housing, about retail sales. And then the next month, everything changes, right? So why are we obsessing about these numbers from month to month? And then the markets obsess over them. And then, dear listener, you start obsessing over them. GDP. We get a number, it changes the next month. We had unemployment this week. 115,000 jobs created. Unemployment rate dips down to 8.1%. But you know what? We're probably going to get a revision of that next month. So I decided to ask our Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore to come in and talk about this obsession with us. Hello, my dear.
Hello.
So what are we supposed to think about this? You know, when the numbers came out on Friday, I heard both, oh, woe is us, and I heard, ah, not so bad.
Yeah, both those people are right. Sadly. But, you know, there's something else that should remind you of, which is being in a sports stadium, right? It's like we're rooting for our team. We want
we're doing the wave.
Yeah. You know, we want unemployment down. We want it up. You know, so we're thinking about this the wrong way. We should not be looking at unemployment as rooting for our team. We should be looking at the league stats, okay?
Okay.
What the real economy is doing. And so if you look at the underlying economy, you actually get a little bit nihilist about these jobs numbers. You learn not to trust them so much.
Then what are we supposed to do with the number? I mean, it comes out every month. We get all worked up about it. And then, and this drives me crazy, the next month, we get some big revision of the previous number. Why can't we just wait until they know what the actual number is?
Well, because then who would eat all those hot dogs when the BLS announces its stats on Friday morning at 8:30? We need hot dog sales to go up in this country. The revisions are so significant. I mean, you've hit on a key point here, which is that every time we see these monthly numbers, they get changed one to two more times at least. Yeah. So in February and March, for instance, we added 53,000 more jobs than we thought. And we were so bummed in February and March that, oh, these jobs numbers look terrible. And now we look at them and they're actually not only better than we thought, but over the past 3 months, we're actually, you know, right on target for a slow recovery. Not super impressive, but it's a recovery.
Okay, so are you telling us to basically ignore the monthly jobs numbers at this point?
Yes, put on your Camus hats, get totally existentialist, and ignore them.
All right, but a serious point here, though, is the long-term figure. People seem to be dropping off the payrolls in really big numbers. More than 5 million people unemployed for 6 months or longer. So is this where perhaps we should be focusing our angst?
It certainly is, actually. I mean, those are not trivial numbers. But what's important about them is that those numbers that cause us concern, the long-term unemployed, marginally attached workers who are the ones who are looking for jobs but not really getting anywhere, those numbers are unchanged. And here's why that's actually good. It shows that we're not hemorrhaging. And as soon as we can start putting a stop to the hemorrhaging of jobs, then we can start building back up. But also, we have to take them seriously because These are the numbers that tell us about the state of the economy, the structural state of the economy. Are we set up to grow jobs? Are we set up to grow our GDP? Do we have people trained in the right jobs? That's what those numbers tell us, and they are important to watch. And we should look at them very soberly, and Washington should look at them soberly, because that's where our policies should change.
Are we set up to be able to give all those long-term unemployed people jobs at some point?
That's what's changing in this economy. If you look at where the jobs are being distributed right now, where are they growing, right? In the things that we already know, retail sector, healthcare. But are we adding enough jobs in those? Probably not. So there is room for change there, but it's a really thorny issue to figure out what kind of changes. And, you know, that's why we pay people in Washington the big bucks. So
okay. Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, where's the good news, Heidi? If this is a bit of a mixed bag in the unemployment report, where can we look for those green shoots?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, not only are the revisions showing us that jobs are growing, but productivity is down, which means people are being hired. Productivity is actually down when they're being hired because they're still learning the ropes. They're not doing as much. Average hourly earnings are rising, which is great. And then here's something that's been a thorny issue for a while, bank lending. So the Federal Reserve checks out what banks are doing, and it's finding that lending to not just large companies, but small businesses and individuals is loosening a little bit. That's good news, because not only does it mean that the banks are, you know, letting go of their tight, deathly grip on their wallets, but it also shows that consumers are applying for loans, which means that there's probably something productive they want to use them for.
And if small businesses are getting their loans, hopefully that means they're going to hire.
Hopefully.
Okay. Marketplace's Heidi Moore. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, most young kids in school aren't thinking about the job market, but last week, more than 30 million of them did go to the office with mom and dad. It was the annual Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. The workplaces children are seeing today reflect some of the big changes in the economy since the event started 20 years ago. Marketplace's Eve Tro took her microphone to one office to find out more.
The tech company Belkin has a big glass-plated building in Southern California. It looks even bigger if you're only 4 feet tall, as many of the visitors were last week, for Take Your Children to Belkin Day. Belkin makes digital accessories, computer cables, surge protectors, cell phone chargers. Over breakfast, parents tried to explain their work.
I'm Colin Greenwich, and these are my three daughters.
My name is Callie, and I'm 10.
I'm Ariana, and I'm 12.
I'm Mia, and I'm 7.
So why did you want to bring them to work?
You know, Dad disappears in the morning and comes back in the afternoon. They have no idea what goes on in between. I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm part of the engineering group that looks after case products.
Do you know what your dad does all day at work?
It seems like he gets the work done and has fun at the same time.
Do any of you already have any ideas about what you want to do when you grow up?
I want to be a vet.
I want to work for Cirque du Soleil.
And notice nobody wants to be an engineer yet.
Well, that's my second choice. Okay.
This idea of taking your kids to work for a day started with Nell Merlino. Two decades ago, the Ms. Foundation asked her to come up with a program to encourage girls to pursue careers. She says on the first Take Our Daughters to Work Day 20 years ago, there were few women in their own offices. Most of them sat outside an office, answering phones or typing. She says it was good for girls to see that.
I distinctly, so distinctly remember a story of a woman who turned to the girls at one point who were fascinated by what she was doing. And she said to them, "Don't do what I did." And they sort of looked and they said, "What do you mean?" And she said, don't not finish school, because she hadn't finished school and was stuck in a clerical position. And so there were lots of interesting lessons for girls.
Since then, the day has evolved. Under some political pressure, it became Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. Meanwhile, though, more women than men are going to college, and more women are earning more than men, too. Merlino is now focused not just on getting girls interested in going to work, but in achieving financial independence.
Pew did a survey, and the young women they interviewed, more young women than young men, talked about wanting to make a good living.
And Merlino says she's seen a big change in how children see their parents make a living. More of them see their parents switch companies, change careers, get laid off, and increasingly go to work as small business owners.
We've seen a rapid increase in the number of women who go into business for themselves or create a company, then go on to create jobs for other people. That is a situation where girls learn an enormous amount, particularly if the business starts in the home because they really understand sort of how the sausage gets made because they've watched mommy do it.
Many big companies cut back on programs for Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. Tight times, no budget for those family lunches. But Merlino says more families are taking their children to work every day as the economy transitions toward more entrepreneurship. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We've devoted a lot of time to student loans on this program and will continue to do so. But it's worth noting that while some people are graduating from college owing hundreds of thousands of dollars, the average college grad leaves school with just $24,000 worth of debt. That's not chump change, of course, and the overall debt load is expected to cross $1 trillion this coming week. But commentator Peter Morici says part of the problem lies with employers and with schools.
Young people face a cruel irony. Most can't land a decent job without a college education, yet many graduates earn too little to pay off student loans. College price tags have rocketed, but more importantly, costs have jumped higher than what many graduates earn over their working lifetimes. Many never get out of debt. Americans over 60 still owe $36 billion. Social Security checks are garnished, and debt collectors are harassing borrowers in their 80s. Employers are partially to blame. In the 1950s and 60s, it was commonplace to find folks in jobs as diverse as newspaper reporters and insurance adjusters, having only a high school diploma and some employer training. Nowadays, employers often require a few years of college or even a BA. It's an easy way to screen applicants, but many jobs simply don't pay enough for students to work down six-figure debts. But what students do in college also matters. A degree in engineering or nursing pays a lot more than one in French or sociology. In recent decades, states have cut higher education during hard times, but only partially restored budgets when conditions improve. Community colleges, which offer some of the best technical training, and many universities have cut their programs in engineering, nursing, and the like because they're too expensive. Meantime, many students are herded into cheaper liberal arts. Many college-bound students aren't prepared for and don't want to take the tough majors. But that problem goes back to high school. Our culture is also to blame. Growing up in New York State, I studied Iroquois culture, 20th century child labor abuses, and Governor Al Smith's reforms. And these days in college, students get a steady dose of liberal ideology and are sent out to go find themselves. No surprise, many come to universities only to enjoy intellectually pleasing, but practically useless programs, and end up lost in poorly paying jobs, adrift in a sea of debt.
Peter Morici teaches at the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business. We want to know what you think. Write to us on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org. You have many, many places to stash your cash, including in a $10,000 bottle of Bordeaux.
I mean, I recognize that people can make money through investing in wine, but for me, the central purpose of wine is enjoyment, is pleasure.
Find wine as an investment later on Marketplace Money. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time for a few of your letters. And our senior producer, Patty Hirsch, joins me once again. Hello.
Hello.
So a bit of a quick hit?
A bit of a quick hit, just to respond to some of the feedback we've gotten from listeners.
What do we got this week?
Well, several listeners were a little upset with our call last week to people to use their real names when they correspond with us.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, some people were very happy about it, and they wrote in on Facebook to give us their real names. But David Lane wrote in from Orlando to say that it's the idea that's important, not the name of the person sending it in.
Given that you just said his name, I hope that's okay.
Yes. Yes, he said it was okay to use his name. And I should clarify, by the way, we're not saying that you have to give us your real name, but if you want us to read out your comment on the air, we'd prefer it if you did disclose your identity. Otherwise, we don't even know if the information you're giving us, you know, can be trusted.
This actually just happened, right?
Right. So we read out a post last week by a poster called NJ Nurse, right, who commented about a piece from the previous week in which an interviewee claimed Princeton was a food desert. And the post said that was rubbish because there's a Wild Oats market right in the center of Princeton.
But... is there?
No.
Oops.
No, that was not correct. Joanna Saylor wrote in this week to say that the Wild Oats store closed several years ago. And then I realized what I should have noticed at the time. You know, Wild Oats was actually sold to Whole Foods in 2009, right. So it couldn't have been a Wild Oats right. anyway, although stores are rebranded. My apologies to listeners there, and of course my profound thanks to Joanna, firstly for listening so closely to the show, and secondly for writing in and helping me relearn a valuable lesson.
Now, I also know we got some mail about Michael Ian Black reading from his book.
Yeah, so this is kind of a departure for Marketplace Money. You know, in the spirit of trying new things, I wanted to see how listeners might like to hear a humorist, you know, talking about his spending experience, right. in this case, buying a car.
A BMW,
right. And I thought, you know, many of us, BMW drivers or not, would be able to identify with him or at least observe something of the human condition in the piece.
And how'd that go down?
Well, it was interesting. It was kind of a 50-50 split, with some commentators hating it and calling it pointless, while others loved hearing some humor on the show. And, you know, I know this is a show about personal finance, but, you know, I do want to sort of expand a little bit so we have sort of humor and other things in it to make people understand that it's about, that personal finance is about life.
It is, indeed. And it doesn't mean we're ignoring retirement or investment, of course.
Absolutely. Those decisions are a big part of, you know, the allocation of your resources, if you like, just like, you know, doing your taxes or, you know, buying a home.
Speaking of buying a home, Freddie Mac released the mortgage rates this week. Record low average 30-year mortgage, 3.84%.
Yeah.
And that's bonkers.
That's bonkers.
It's free money.
Close to free, yeah. I mean, this is a historical low, and it brings up a question that we get a lot, both from listeners and actually around the Marketplace editorial table at our morning meetings. Who the heck is getting that rate of 3.84%?
Not me. I think not most of us.
No. In fact, it's almost impossible to get a flat rate that low, even if you have stellar credit score, huge down payment.
Okay, so then, Patty, I'm going to interrupt you and ask how can that be an average then?
I gave the people at Freddie Mac a call to get to the bottom of this because I was trying to figure it out. And it turns out that in order to get that rate, borrowers would have to prepay a certain amount of their mortgage interest.
Okay, this is what's called paying points.
Right, you know, so you pay the lender, say, 1% or 1 point of your mortgage, and that's like a prepayment of your interest, in return for which you get a lower monthly interest rate on your loan.
Okay, so basically what we're saying here is that this Freddie Mac rate that you hear all the time, that's not just a flat, like, 3.84%. There's something else going on.
It is not. So, you know, you shouldn't think about that whenever you're talking to your mortgage broker. Right. You know, you should be thinking about what they're asking you to pay points, because that will bring that rate down.
Okay. And so there are actually, I think, a lot of online calculators that can help you out with this, right?
Yeah. My favorite is this. It's one called The Mortgage Professor. It's a real simple one. I can put that on the website so people can check it out.
And thanks for coming through the mailbag.
My pleasure.
If you would like to respond to us, you can go to the website. You can tweet Patty at Patty Hirsch, tweet me at Radio Tess, or find us on Facebook. Thanks, Patty.
Thanks, Tess.
Well, I nearly wrote a letter this week to the New York Times. That was after I read Joe Nocera's column about his disappointment with the 401k. Now, he did take most of the blame for the issues that he faced in his 401k, but not before quoting Teresa Ghilarducci, a labor economist who calls the 401k a failed experiment. So I thought I'd ask Mrs. Ghilarducci on the show to explain. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start by citing actually a tweet that I saw earlier in the week in follow-up to Joe Nocera's column. Carl Richards, a financial advisor that we've had on the show, he put this whole thing this way. Why blame the car for bad driving? That the 401k didn't fail, investors did.
That's hilarious, because investors are people who need retirement accounts. So if the vehicle is not appropriate for people, then it's a failed program.
So you're saying what we have is a lemon on our hands.
The Congress could do a lot better with that $140 billion that it gives away in tax breaks for 401ks.
Outline for us the major problems that you see with the 401k system.
Sure. Over 30 years, we found that over half the people don't have a 401k, they don't have anything, that when they do have it, they pay fees that actually diminish their accounts to either 20 to 40%, if they even know what those fees are. All the investments are short-term, and when they distribute it, it's in a lump sum. 30 years, the system has not fixed itself. It's time for something new.
This debate was reignited, of course, by Joe Nocera's column, and I think it got over 1,000 comments from readers there alone. But I wonder if he's the best example of someone managing their 401k, because, you know, he rated it to buy a house. He invested in the tech bubble. You know, in short, he made a lot of mistakes that were, you know, due to his own decisions, not necessarily the 401k.
It turns out, if you look at what most people do with their 401k, who are about that age, mm-hmm. you know, over 50, he's the middle of sort of the first wave of boomers. It turns out that what he did is not that unusual to us, that he took money out for his house. He also said that he took money out because of his divorce. A lot of people in that age group are divorced.
Right.
He's also high income, and those are the folks that have 401ks.
Right.
I'm really looking at the whole population. 80% have nothing.
If you could just design your ideal retirement plan for the vast majority of the population, what would that look like?
Oh, that's easy. So my ideal plan has the Social Security system as a base. On top of that should be individual accounts where workers put money aside for every hour they work for their retirement.
Mandated?
But it should be mandated, because without a mandate, only about 50% of the people participate. And the disbursement is not when people need money. That should be a savings account. But the disbursement of the retirement account should happen at retirement.
How do you mandate something like that if it's not just being automatically taken out of your paycheck like Social Security?
You're right. You can't mandate it for people who aren't working. If you're employed and you pay unemployment insurance tax and disability tax and Social Security tax, just add your contribution on top of that. It would be Social Security plus.
Yeah.
How much you put in is how much you get out, and the principal is guaranteed.
The $60,000 question here is whether we actually think that the 401k system will be changed.
I think the 401k system should be viewed for what it is, that it's a good plan for people at the highest earning brackets. I'm not recommending that system go away. Everybody who has it and they're happy with it, God bless them. But most people don't have anything, and we need a plan to cover everybody.
Teresa Ghilarducci, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Now, for these next stories, you might want to find a comfortable chair, slice up some good cheese, and pop a cork, because it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and we're going to talk about wine. We, as a country, drank more than 4 billion bottles of wine last year. Retail value, $32 billion, according to the Wine Institute. So, do the math. That is an average of about $8 a bottle, right? Now, would an $8 bottle be a good wine? How do you know?
Hold the glass up and examine the wine against the light. You're looking for color and clarity. Now, stick your nose in it. Maybe some strawberry. Oh, there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Oh, Miles. Sure, that's one way. You could go wine tasting in Santa Barbara, as they did in the movie Sideways, or perhaps Napa, Sonoma, as I did a couple of weeks ago. Pretty much my favorite pastime. You could also attend a wine class.
So what I want to do tonight is I'm attempting to give you a glimpse of a couple of key things you need to know about if you're going to drink Burgundy. All
That's right? an instructor at the Wine House, an 18,000 square foot retail store just off the 405 freeway here in L.A. They do classes once a month, and you could look for something similar in your neighborhood. But in case there isn't one, we asked Winehouse owner Jim Knight to answer some very basic questions about buying wine. And to start, what goes into a wine's price?
Well, the first thing is definitely supply and demand. But you also, I mean, let's take it all the way back to the vineyard. Your land costs, your labor costs, you know, everything that goes into that. If you're using new French oak barrels in your wine, that's going to bring up your cost. But the market brings up the cost of the wine as well. I mean, there may be something like a Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. Is they make hundreds of thousands of cases, where Chateau Petrus, they make 500 cases for the whole world. So it's,
but even at 500 cases, it better taste good. So
yeah,
no,
yeah, it better. So yeah, I mean, that all goes into what makes a bottle expensive. Are your labels embossed, or is it just a cheap piece of paper? Is it a thick, heavy bottle, or is it just a regular, normal bottle? The difference between a $2 bottle of glass and a $10 bottle of glass, all those factors. So,
Now, supply and demand is dictated mostly by what people decide they like, right? So how do you know what you like?
If it feels good on your palate, then that usually means it's going to be a crowd pleaser wine.
What does that mean, if it feels good on your palate? What wouldn't feel good?
What wouldn't feel good?
Yeah, obviously you don't want vinegar, but...
Yeah, what wouldn't feel good is a wine that's really super tannic. Tannins come from the skins of the grape or even the oak as well. If you taste a glass of wine and you feel like you need a glass of water afterwards, that's not a very refined, delicious wine. So, and if there's maybe too much acidity and that hits you like right in your jowls, then that doesn't feel good either. So you want something that's creamy, that's lush, that's juicy, that's round, that's opulent, and delicious.
Can you take us to a wine that you would consider very nice on the palate?
Yeah, and
Perhaps affordable?
And very nice on the old pocketbook as well. Yeah, follow me.
He marched us over to an area with wines from outside the U.S., specifically Spain.
This is actually a wine that's called Blau. It's from Spain. It's kind of a blend of Grenache and Cabernet, and it's $10.99 a bottle. And I know this is a radio show, so you can't see it, but the packaging is very expensive. And this is an $11 bottle of wine. And we haven't really talked about points at all, but I'll mention there is the Wine Spectator gave this wine 91 points. So 91 points for a wine that's under $15 is unbelievable. People use points simply the same way that somebody that's interested in a car would use Road and Tracker. Mm. That's where what people end up looking for. They look for high score, low price.
Does that make sense if you're just an average consumer? Is the score something that you should really pay attention to? Really subjective.
I think the first thing you should pay attention to is find a reputable wine store. They'll learn your palate. Now, if you don't have that, where a lot of people are shopping in places like Costco and grocery stores and stuff like that. And so that way, I think you should use scores.
And Jim had one more piece of advice for getting to know what is worth spending your money on. Have your own tasting party.
For doing wine tastings and stuff like that at the home, stick to themes. You know, let's do a Cabernet tasting. Let's do a Sonoma tasting. Let's do a South of France tasting. Keep it simple, because then you can get people to put money in each bottle with you. So if there's six people tasting out of one bottle, that's a lot cheaper than one person buying that one bottle. Because really what we're talking about here, it's fermented grape juice, people. Let's not get all high and mighty about it.
Well, Jim Knight, thank you so much for taking us on a tour of wine today. Really appreciate it. Bottoms up.
All right. Cheers.
Now, I don't really know why anyone would buy something so delicious and then never drink it. But that's just me. In actuality, investors have been pouring into the wine market recently. Some of the profits from investing in Bordeaux vintages, like Chateau Lafite 82, have been, wait for it, intoxicating. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, investors dabbling in wine need to keep their wits about them.
Often the beauty of a tangible asset is you get to handle your investment, but not if that asset is fine wine.
That's from the Languedoc. That needs drinking quite soon. Oh, some Merlot from South Africa.
This is Will McLaren, rummaging through his wine rack, looking for something to drink. But he doesn't get to touch the wine he's invested in.
The first point to make is that it's held in storage, and therefore I don't come home from the pub and decide to open up a case and see what it's like.
The wine has to be stored in precisely the right cellar conditions if you want it to improve over time and appreciate in value. McLaren's rather glad he hasn't dipped into his portfolio. 6 cases of vintage Bordeaux and 2 cases of Champagne.
It has returned, you know, on average 27% over the last 4 years for me, which I think is a pretty good investment when you stack it up against the equity market.
McLaren started buying fine wines after the financial crisis of 2008. He's a banker by trade, but Adrian Lenegan, boss of Provenance Fine Wines, says he's now selling wine as an investment to people from many walks of life.
We have clients ranging from prison officers to painter and decorators to high court judges and architects and policemen.
And he tells them all the same thing. Treat your investment like a fine wine. Expect it to mature gradually.
I would never allow somebody to become a client of ours unless they had the expectation that they would hold on to their wines for at least 5 years.
That's just as well. Wine prices are not looking too hot at the moment.
Lafitte 11, now 4.9. Just
the index of the top 100 vintages has fallen sharply over the past year. The index is calculated here at Livex, a fine wine exchange in London.
Eglise Cliné 05. Yeah, you've got some six-packs.
In the 12 years since Livex was set up, the global market for fine wines has grown fourfold to more than $4 billion a year. Over the past decade, the index is up by more than 160%. But, says Livex founder Justin Gibbs, the index has seen two big falls within that period.
One was post-Lehman Brothers, when it dropped 20%, and one was last August with the euro crisis, when again it effectively dropped 20%.
So along with the thrills, wine investing has also had its spills, and in some cases it's left a particularly bitter taste. I met wine expert Jim Budd at a wine tasting in central London.
It's got wonderful orange and tangerine flavours.
Jim's been exposing some of the pitfalls in the wine investment business. Over the past 4 years, 50 wine investment firms here have collapsed, either through fraud or mismanagement. Investors are reckoned to have lost more than $160 million. Jim does not invest in wine.
I mean, I recognise that people can make money through investing in wine, but for me, the central purpose of wine is enjoyment, is pleasure.
Investor Will McLaren, however, is happy to continue holding his 8 cases of wine, along with his 27% profit. He can afford to be philosophical, especially about this particular asset.
If the bottom falls out of the market, you can drink it.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Many high-earning professional athletes find themselves in financial trouble.
The average career was 3.7 years long. That's why I only said I only had $4 million, because you couldn't count anything past that.
NFL legend Warren Sapp gives his first broadcast interview since declaring Chapter 7 bankruptcy, next on Marketplace Money from APM. Last month, a familiar story hit the front page of the sports section. Multi-millionaire athlete declares bankruptcy. This time, it was 39-year-old football legend Warren Sapp. He played defensive tackle for 13 seasons in the NFL, won a Super Bowl title with Tampa Bay in 2002, and banked, by his own count, $60 million. Now he's filed for Chapter 7 liquidation. According to court papers, he owes creditors more than $6.7 million. Sapp says he made bad real estate investments just before the housing bust, among other financial woes. And because of the debt, his paychecks as an analyst for the NFL Network were garnished. Now, he is hardly alone. According to Sports Illustrated, nearly 80% of NFL players file for bankruptcy within 2 years of their retirement. Warren Sapp joins us in studio for his first broadcast interview since the court filing. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You have recently been in the news for a bankruptcy filing.
Me?
Oh. Yes. Did you not hear about that?
Nah.
Oh, okay. Well, a lot of Americans look at famous athlete, famous celebrity, famous Hollywood person who ends up having to declare bankruptcy, and they just don't understand how that happens.
Let me see if I can put this in a context.
Yeah.
When I was in a locker room and I was surrounded by other millionaires, other $100,000 men, there was three things that we kept off the table. That was your significant other or your wife. We're going to leave your children off the table because they're not mine. I don't want to support them. I have my own to support. And money. Because I don't make it. I'm not paying your mortgage. You're not paying mine.
You just didn't talk about it.
You shouldn't worry about mine. And in that sense, I wouldn't expect a regular person that's at 9 to 5 to understand what I'm going through. And there's nothing I'm going to say here today that's really going to give them any clarity on it. And what you read and what you hear and how you interpret it is all on you.
Sure. But, you know, you were even mentioning on the way into the studio, you know, $60 million.
And I made $60 million.
Right. So how do you go from $60 million to a Chapter 7?
Three things happen, because normally things happen in threes, right? My salary went from $5 million to under $1 million. I went through a divorce. They say it's cheaper to keep. I found that out literally. And the financial crisis that hit this country. With those three things happening at one time, it really put me in a unique situation. And I fought for a good 11, 12 months, reaching and grabbing and doing whatever I could. And trust me, you don't choose this.
No, I'm sure no one would.
You weigh your gains and minuses, and I had to make a decision. And it was either that or not be able to support my children. And I'll take supporting my children over anything else.
Do you have any regrets about decisions, financial decisions that you made, ways that you managed your money that people might learn from?
Always have your hand on the steering wheel. Don't allow a business partner that you think knows your best interest to be able to do things. That's what really, really, you know, tripped me up and got me into a situation where I couldn't untangle it, and it was going to cost me more to untangle it than it was worth. So
you felt like you weren't as involved?
No, I didn't have my hand on it. I was on the other side of the country, and I was trusting someone that, you know, I felt like, you know, they had a hand on the pulse of the situation and the hand and the pulse on our situation within the investment that we were making. But boy, was I wrong. Real rough. The one time in my life I get into business with somebody and it turns upside down on me. Ugh, I couldn't believe it.
So we were interested in talking with you, particularly with the NFL draft having just happened, about what it's like for a young football player to suddenly have to deal with a paycheck that is beyond that of what most Americans can even dream of. Do you remember what that was like for you?
Yeah, I do. A very fond memory of it. You know, when you're sitting there and you're holding a check for $667,000, you look at that and you hold it for a second. And I remember thinking, I could spend $1,000 for the next 365 days and almost not hit half of this. Yeah, but then you learn about, you got to put some away because they really didn't take the proper tax rate out. And, you know, you learn about that at that point. So it's a little different.
What do they help you out with at that point in time?
Nothing. Nobody. You're a grown man. Who's supposed to help you? When I came into the league, it wasn't a rookie symposium or anything. Like now, they do a wonderful job. They give them rookie symposium. They lowered the agent rate to it only could max up at 3%. You know, it used to be guys had – it was all kind of people playing different rates. So they made it a universal system. They've improved it a lot.
So how did you manage it earlier in your career? What did you do to educate yourself?
There was nothing I could do. I mean, where was I going to go?
So you just put it in a checking account?
No. I got lucky. I met a guy when I was in college at Oppenheimer. And when Oppenheimer was, I don't know if they're still running now, but, you know, I went and did a summer course up there and found out about variable, you know, mutual fund and variable annuities and different stuff like that. And you feel like you're investing. You feel like you put it somewhere safe. And then 10 years, you go back and look and see where it's at.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to set straight for the record?
This is the one thing I do want to set straight, because it was written at the beginning like I was a deadbeat dad. You do not pay your child support in the great state of Florida. I am more than current. My children are well taken care of. So everybody out there, don't worry about the SAP children. I'll eat trash before my children are not taken care of.
Why did you come and talk to us about this?
You know what? I didn't have a problem with it because y'all extended the invitation. The marketplace is a beautiful place for me to get my message out without any clutter, without any ambiguity. This was a chance for me to get my word out there. To just set it straight, maybe not. Some may listen, some may not, but they have it now.
Well, Warren Sapp, thank you for coming in.
Not a problem.
And you can find an extended version of our conversation at marketplace.org. Mr. Sapp has been keeping busy since finishing second on Dancing with the Stars. He's got a new show on Fox called Stardate and an upcoming biography titled Sapp Attack. Let's turn now to John Peterson, who's been advising professional athletes about their finances for more than two decades. He's a registered principal with Next Level Financial Group in Sausalito, California, and he currently represents 65 NFL players. I asked him why so many pro athletes find themselves in a financial penalty box.
This is the thing, and you try to sell this concept to guys. What do most human beings do on this planet? We go to work. The better we work, the more we get paid. Along that path of getting paid more, we meet Mr. or Mrs. Wrong, we make mistakes, we do bad investments, we have accidents in our cars. But what are we ultimately trying to do? Save enough money that we pay off our house and never work again. Athletes reverse that model. They start out with enough money to buy a home, a car, houses, take care of everything. And you know, if they're big enough and they're a first rounder, then they'll have maybe enough money to never work again. And all I can do is really make mistakes that draw that income down. So they're not making that income every year the rest of their life. And I think some of them get caught up in that thought process.
Well, John, if a player is willing to listen, what's the first thing that you tell them to do with their paycheck?
Well, first thing we tell them to do is figuring out a budget. There's a lot of nonsense and conversation about what to do with money. The reality is these kids are moving to a new town, and they're taking on their first job. They need to find a tax-free money market fund, sock all their cash into it. They need to fix a budget. And, you know, so the next phase of the operation is really keeping the new friends and families away. You know, your enemies become friends and your friends become enemies with money. And, you know, all of a sudden people can't go to work, the cars don't work, the bills can't get paid, and, you know, and they start that little slow grind. And it's a difficult place to be with family. So where guys really fail is they go out and they buy the $3 million home and then hope their contracts grow into it. And all of a sudden they get hurt, they get cut. So trying to keep them as liquid as possible is what you're trying to advise them to do. But we tell them, set up a bank account, let's get a CPA, know your deductions. You are a company and you're the product of your company.
One of the main themes of the conversation that we had with Warren Sapp was he talked about how important it was to stay in touch with where his money was going and that he did not do that.
Yep.
What exactly is your role as a financial advisor to these pro athletes?
Well, the one thing I will do, though, is educate these kids. I can teach everybody how to fish, but I'm only going fishing with a few. Look up the investment guy and find out if he's got bankruptcies, arrest records, judgments against him. I mean, his investment advice is going to be directly correlated to how much trouble he's in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something guys need to learn. And you'd be surprised how many guys that have been able to get to these kids. The other thing, too, is how we handle things. We run a website for guys, a secured website, that they can put all their investments, their mortgages, cars, credit cards, airline miles, everything on one website. So they can go in and look every day what their money is doing, pros and cons, mortgages and everything else. One's in green, one's in red. And that way they can see where their money is.
Well, this may be an odd question given the rarefied air that pro athletes breathe, but is there anything that the rest of us can learn from the mistakes that these mostly guys have been making?
Well, I think the day-to-day things that get them is marry the right person. You know, if you don't believe marriage is a business, then go to a divorce court and hear what they talk about. It's dividing up the assets. You know, save your money. Make sure that you spend less, you know, spend less than you make. And
it's as basic as that.
A lot of these guys are just controlling expenses and understanding that it will end.
So it's really the same basic lesson whether you're making $20,000 or $200,000.
Sure. Because, you know, at the end of the day, these are 20-year-old kids with money. And most people listening to the show have a 20-year-old. If you gave them $5 million, would they listen to you? But the dynamics are the same. It depends on how you got the money. If you won the lottery or, in this case, you're playing sports, those things are lucky and unique and maybe not going to last. But a kid in football is no different than the kid in the Silicon Valley who has a sheet of paper that says he's worth millions, and he thinks to himself, well, I'm worth millions today. I'll be a billionaire by the end of the year. So it doesn't matter if I overspend or I do something stupid. Well, yeah, it does, because it won't last.
John Peterson is a registered principal with Next Level Financial Group in Sausalito, California. He currently represents 65 NFL players, among some other pro athletes. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Well, from the finances of the manliest among us to, well, the rest. Though he feels comfortable wondering aloud if he would be a better Girl Scout than a Boy Scout, author Joel Stein went on a quest for manliness. His man journey, as he dubbed it, saw him enroll in a 3-day Marine boot camp, work as an LA firefighter for a day, and even get in the ring with the UFC Hall of Famer. Stein documents those adventures in his new book, Man Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really excited about this.
Talk to me about manliness and money. Do manly men handle money differently?
I mostly dealt with this very ancient Scotch-Irish southern version of masculinity. You know, the hunting, fighting, camping. But I did one chapter where I did the blue state version of masculinity, which is I got a day trader to give me $100,000 of his money and let me trade it for the day, which was amazing. Yeah, day trading is not what I thought it would be at all. I thought you did what you and I would do if buying a stock, like find out what the company does, see who their CEO is, and maybe look at their P&E. No. They only hold these stocks for a few seconds. So they are just, it's like poker. They're just looking at the psychology of the other people buying it and trying to guess whether it's going to go up or down in those few seconds. I don't recommend day trading.
Although but did it make you more manly?
It did make me more manly.
How so?
It's all about risk taking. You have to have a lot of manliness is about confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of risk taking because you're gambling. Well, in my case, someone else's money, but he was sitting right next to me. So that's still a lot of pressure.
But back to the question of whether manly men handle money differently. Did any of these experiences change what you're doing?
Well, the problem with manly men is they should not be allowed to touch money.
Really?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they should immediately hand all their money over to any woman in their life, for sure.
Well, what does that tell us about Wall Street then?
Oh, Wall Street's a mess. You don't want your money involved in
Wall
Street.
Because they're all manly men?
You know, if you can distance yourself from the manly men and let them duke it out and just get the gains from their fighting, like with an index fund,
mm-hmm.
then you're way ahead because you're just exploiting their fight. But you don't want to get involved in their fight. Yeah. All downside. Yeah.
I don't know. I've been to Wall Street and I don't find them terribly manly.
Well, they're manly in a certain kind of way, right? They're not manly in a construction worker kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ugly side of masculinity. The problem with manliness is there's two versions, right? There's the construction and the destruction. So the most manly movie in the world is A Bridge on the River Kwai. The only manlier movie than The Bridge on the River Kwai would be Two Bridges on the River Kwai, because you get to destroy two bridges and then rebuild two bridges. I watch my son do it with Legos all day long.
Just build and destroy.
Yeah. At first, it was just destroy. He'd make me build things and then he'd destroy them. I felt like I was teaching him how to be a terrorist. But now he's into the building and then destroying. So it's a big step up in manliness.
Well, speaking of your son, the entire book really does boil down to, I think, a message for him, right? You know, you deal with competition, male bonding, surviving the outdoors. So how about we create another chapter? And what message do you want him to take away about money?
I'm very conservative with my money. It's what my dad taught me. My dad's a really good investor, and he spent a lot of time boring the crap out of me with how to invest, but it's sunk in. Like, I know how to do it now, and I meet people who don't, and it's shocking, right? I can't believe Money Magazine comes out every month. It's like you can tell people once, and they get it, but people don't. And so, you know, it's really a way of thinking and living. I want to teach my son that, but I'm going to teach him to be a little more aggressive than I am. That's what I learned from the day trader, that if you understand risk, you can incorporate it into your life a little better. Although I don't own any bonds right now, and I'm 40. So that's kind of pushing.
It's risky, but you would encourage your son to do this.
I would encourage my son to go bondless.
Bondless?
Bondless, yeah, and just risk it all. I think that's a manlier way to invest.
Joel Stein, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you could say that Joel's man quest was really a series of internships. So maybe we should have saved that for a segment we're planning on working for free. That's coming up in the next few weeks. So do you have an internship horror story? Reach out and give us all the gory details on Facebook, Twitter, or at marketplace.org. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and the home of listener Katie Davis. She wrote to us on Facebook about the Pay Yourself First system that her husband Matt instituted in their home. Automatic investments out of their checking account each month, a budgeting spreadsheet, maxing out their IRAs. And she's most grateful that he made all of this routine so that she could maintain the system while he deployed to Afghanistan for 8 months. His financial leadership, she wrote, has enabled us to live well within our means and save, save, save for the future. He would get such a kick out of getting one of your blue piggy banks. So, Piggy is on the way, Katie. With this one caveat, I know your barbecue is delicious there in North Carolina, but this pig will not do you any good on a spit slathered in sauce. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we are spending what to keep our kids in sports?
Our goal as parents is to help our children reach their potential as athletes. Don't worry so much about whether they have the $25 bat or the $300 bat, despite what the marketing pitches might indicate.
the billion-dollar business of outfitting Junior for the field. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by the American Institute of CPAs new Chartered Global Management Accountant designation, CGMA, established with the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants to recognize professional accountants helping business succeed. CGMA.org.
This is APM.